Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm Mark Askren, University of Nebraska-Lincoln. It's my pleasure to convene this session today, both for all of you here on site and for those of you viewing from the virtual conference. Today's session is Open Networks for Social and Connected Learning. Appreciate the sponsorship by Accenture. And I'll introduce our speaker in just a moment. We'll get started. Dr. Mimi Ito is a cultural anthropologist and professor locally here at University of California, Irvine. After today's session at 11:20, she'll be available out in the foyer right outside to continue the conversation as listed in your program for an additional 30 minutes, which we appreciate. So at this point in time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Ito.
Great. Thanks so much. Well, it's lovely to be here today with you all, and also to be virtually with all the invisible folks on the internet. It's always nice when the internet is part of the party, so I'm glad to be in a real virtual conference setting here, and also to be with all of you, this community, and this event, which is really dedicated to grappling with what I think of as some of the most challenging and also interesting kind of struggles we're having in adapting our institutions of education to be in line with the 21st century learner and today's technologies. And I know that there's been so much talk these days about how our education system is in crisis and how kids these days, they're distracted and they're antisocial and we're in big trouble here. But I actually feel like for those of us here who are in the field of technology and education, that it's a really exciting time. And there's so much opportunity to make a really big difference in ways that are so fundamental that it's really fabulous to be part of conversations like you all are having here this week. I wanted to start by just sharing a small personal story, which for me was an indicator of how times really are changing in our field. And this is a story from my home life. I have a middle schooler, my son's in middle school, and the kids at his middle school a couple years ago started advocating for an elective in Minecraft. And Minecraft, if you guys don't have kids at home, is a game that it's kind of like Legos on the internet that you do socially. It's a lot about DIY construction and hacking, but also with an interesting twist that you have to build your house before dark, otherwise the monsters will get you. So there's a really interesting sort of building plus survival kind of aspect to the game. Anyway, it's a huge phenomenon among the middle school set. And so the kids, you know, they did this long petition. They found a teacher who said they would teach the elective, actually the technology coordinator for the school. They finally brought it to the assistant principal and got this elective approved. And of course, you know, everybody signed up. There's a waiting list. It's hugely popular. And it was really interesting for me because it was sort of this moment where you saw kids bringing their culture of learning in their social and recreational lives in school, and also in a really interesting way, it made what was happening in school visible to us at home because the kids were logging into the server and negotiating all these issues about governance and griefing and hacking and so on in ways that were visible to parents because it was this openly networked environment. And these are the kinds of dynamics that I have been interested in studying for a long time. You know, I've been doing work for decades now on games and learning and mobile phones and digital media production. And even 5 years ago, I never would have predicted that in my kids' public middle school, and this isn't a tech-focused school at all, that you would see a Minecraft elective that was initiated by the kids. And I think it's a real sign of our times that, you know, we're starting to take for granted that these boundaries that used to be so firm between things like games and education are suddenly becoming a little bit more porous. Now, it's not like the culture shift has totally happened yet. So just last week, I was at a parent event at the school, and one parent raises her hand, and she says, "Oh my God, what is with this Minecraft elective? I've been spending the past few years trying to get my daughter off Minecraft, and she comes home and says there's Minecraft at school, and, you know, you're making my job much more difficult. And then another parent raises their hand and says, you should really try playing the game. It's amazing. It's about problem solving. It's about construction. And so we're at this really interesting moment where things are starting to shift. We're not at the end of the shift yet, but we're having a really interesting and lively set of debates, I think, about the relationship between in-school and out-of-school, between consumer technologies and educational technologies, and a lot of the boundaries that used to be really hardened in our institutional and social world are starting to be malleable in some new ways. So the reality is that the world outside of the classroom has already transformed itself in terms of learning. Education might not be transformed yet, but learning has been transformed. And this is the world of Minecraft and all of the social and recreational learning that young people are doing on the internet today. As we all know, our institutions are slower to change than kids' activities. And our institutions of education were founded in a very different era in relation to information and knowledge flow and social connectivity. And really, our genres and our policies were hardened in an era when information was scarce, when we really did have to rely on classrooms and textbooks and expertise in particular formats that were delivered through the forms of education that are still dominant today. Now, the open networks, this incredible abundance of knowledge, of information, of social connectivity that today's online world offers us, offers tremendous opportunity for new kinds of learning experiences that are production-oriented, inquiry-based, that are about authentic problem-solving and civic engagement. But we're really not there yet and have to make a much more concerted effort across sectors, whether it's education, technology, policymakers, parents, in order to guide learners to this kind of opportunity. So this question about what do we need to do collectively in order to help all young people really tap the learning potential of today's new digital age is the central question that has been animating the work that I've been doing together with a network of colleagues in the MacArthur Foundation's Digital Media and Learning Initiative over the past 10 years or so. And there are a lot of ways that you could address this fundamental problem, this shift that I think we all recognize has happened in the world outside the classroom. My own work and the work of the DML Initiative has focused on what we believe to be a critical piece, which is really how can we leverage new technology to make the connections between our schools, our institutions of higher education, and our communities, and the peer cultures and interests that young people have. How can we make those connections much more robust and mobilized in the service of learning? Now, this is not a new agenda from a learning philosophy point of view. It's what Dewey talked about many, many decades ago, which is about education being seamless with life. And this really should be the central public mission of our educational institutions in the digital age, because suddenly we've been handed a new set of resources to make the vision of education that Dewey advocated for a reality for so many more young people. Our educational institutions, our institutions of higher education, certainly should not be just about delivering expertise. The ivory tower model, especially in an era of information abundance, is increasingly not the only game in town, and neither is necessarily the assessment and credentialing when learning is happening everywhere, and we are all lifelong learners in a world of rapid change. Our educational institutions need to deliver expertise. They need to do the credentialing, but they also need to connect young people to the learning that is part of their social lives, about their communities, that connects to their interests, their careers, and technology can really be a powerful ally for this agenda. I'll try to get much more concrete about this, first by presenting some of the research that what do we know about how young people are engaging with media and how does that relate to their learning. And then I'll talk about this model of connected learning that we've been developing as part of the Digital Media and Learning Initiative that really cuts across research, design, policy, and practice, and then end with some guiding principles and examples for how we might start to realize connected learning in many more settings of young people's lives. So first, some of the data on the quantitative side. I usually like to start with a reminder that even though kids these days are all digital and networky, they also read a lot. So I've really appreciated the Pew Library research that has really underscored the fact that young people are avid readers. And in fact, Americans between the ages of 16 and 29 are much more likely to be reading than older generations. And they read books, they read magazines, they read newspapers, long-form online formats. So it's not just that they're reading texts and tweets. The thing that really has changed is the degree of media saturation in young people's lives. And this is where the Kaiser work on, especially because they survey really young kids, has been really important and interesting. And the last round of survey work they did demonstrated that 8 to 18-year-olds devote, on average, 7.5 hours a day to media consumption. And this is in the context of multitasking. So if you disaggregate that, it's actually almost 11 hours a day of media crammed into that 7.5 hours. So young people are media saturated. That's where they're getting their information. They're immersed in a constant stream of media. The other big shift, obviously, is gaming. Gaming is the entertainment medium of our time. It surpassed movies in revenue several years ago. The demographic is getting multi-generational as well as cross-genders. Virtually all teenagers play games. So this is really what kids are doing these days. And then, of course, social media. You know, we did a lot of our research in the early years of social media adoption. As is typical in industrialized countries, teenagers have sort of led the adoption curve on social network sites. So that top blue line is the youngest age group. Now you'll see that there's been a pretty dramatic growth curve, higher than other age groups until a couple years ago. Apparently, after mom gets Facebook, the teenagers stop leaving, but they're still higher proportions. And then, of course, text messaging. The U.S. was pretty late to the party, but has caught up to roughly the numbers that most industrial and post-industrial countries achieve in the teen demographic once you reach saturation of texting. So about 50 texts a day for boys, about 100 texts a day for girls. This is the dominant way that people stay in touch with each other these days. So what happens when these media-saturated kids walk into the classroom? And what we're seeing is a culture clash between the modes and institutions of learning that were perfected in a prior age of information scarcity and what young people are experiencing in their everyday lives of constant immersion in this free-flowing, networked knowledge economy. So the abundance of media can in many ways be too much of a good thing. Young people are pursuing their online interests in tandem with what we've seen as growing pressures for achievement, first to get into college and then to get into careers. There's definitely been an escalation in the pressures that young people experience, not only in their core academic pursuits, but also in their extracurricular resume building and in the contraction of the market for good jobs. So as a parent, I'm constantly struggling with, the fact that I very much appreciate my young, my kids being able to have, time to explore, to mess around online, and all those things that I think are actually great for young people's learning and development, but also just to say, lids down, time for bed. There's a whole host of challenges that I think young people are facing today that are different from other generations. Now, I'm sort of curious to take the temperature of folks here in this room about how you feel about sort of what's happening in the wilds of the internet and the relationship to learning and education. If you could humor me a little bit and give me a body pull where thumbs up is you feel like, all the stuff that's happening online and with gaming is a good thing for kids' learning and development, for education. Thumbs down being that, you know, it's more of a negative and a distraction. And sideways being maybe it depends on the kid, or sometimes yes, sometimes no. Oh, interesting. Ah, mostly positive. I don't see any thumbs down. Yeah. So you're my people. Yeah. So it's challenging, right? Because when kids take to the online world, they do things that we think are great, like forming study groups, problem solving, looking for stuff online. But they also do things that are maybe not so awesome, like, you know, going to SparkNotes instead of doing the reading, you know, checking ratemyprofessors.com so you can avoid the hard graders, or, you know, of course, the cheating and downloading ready-made essays. And then my latest favorite is, you know, services that will take your online course for you to get an A. So now that the flow of knowledge and information is becoming so much more robust and speedy at the student and peer-to-peer layer, there's really no way we can fully inhibit this kind of sharing. Now, what can we do about it? We can sit back and lament the fact that things don't work the way they used to, and that our cherished ways of teaching and instruction are not working, and their kids are cheating and getting around the rules. Or we can start to think about how can we use that amazing peer-to-peer flow and sharing as an enabler rather than a distraction from learning. The problem with this kind of, you know, behind-the-scenes activity is it happens when learning is disconnected from meaningful purpose, when it's disconnected from real problem solving and authentic inquiry, when it's just about getting the grade, when it's about putting a line in a resume or transcript, when it's about filling in the blanks for answers that the teacher already knows in advance. That's when this happens. So this is a challenge we're facing. You know, a lot of us have to adapt the way we do things. So what do we know from the research about how young people are responding to this new kind of environment, this new digital world? I wrapped up a study. This is, I guess we finished up 5 or 6 years ago at this point, but it was really in an ethnographic study that was conducted in kind of the heyday of MySpace and that first big flourishing of social network sites, if you remember back then. And it was really an interesting move on the part of the MacArthur Foundation to say, look, you know, kids are learning differently. A lot of, if not most of the action, particularly then, was happening in the out-of-school space. Let's spend 3 years really looking at the online world, video games, and so on from a kid-centered point of view. And so I went out with a team of ethnographers, and we spent time just, you know, kid's eye view of what was going on. And we found a lot of things. I won't bore you with all the findings, but a few of the most salient ones that have informed our work moving forward. One is the fact that there's a persistent generation gap in how young people and older folks view the value of online activity. So this is a headline that I think picks up that dynamic that emerged from our study really well, which is that young people see, you know, social media and the internet as a lifeline to information, knowledge, and social connectivity, whereas their parents and teachers and professors generally see it as a waste of time. And interestingly enough, this has persisted even when the older generation is now using text messaging and Twitter and Facebook and so on. They still view young people's use of these technologies as a waste of time, even though they may see the value of it. So this is a dynamic that I think we have to get past if we're trying to build those intergenerational kinds of connections that can provide guidance and support and mentorship for young people's use of online technologies. Now, the second important set of findings from our research was really about what young people were learning through these digital engagements. And not surprisingly, we found that young people were learning a ton. And a lot of it had to do with what we could think of as baseline forms of technical literacy, because participating online is just something you have to do to be a social being. If you're a teenager these days, they do pick up a fair amount of both social and technical skills as part of just hanging out with their friends, trying to get a date, and all these things that intersect with technology worlds these days. Things that would have been considered difficult, like modifying photos or putting up a web page or managing an online profile. You know, they're just part of everyday teen culture now, and that technology bar continues to go up. Now, what's ended up being probably more important for the work that we've been doing on connected learning is what we found among a subset of kids, so not the majority of young people in our study, was that some young people were taking to the online world to do really amazingly activated, self-directed learning, media production, civic engagement. These are the kids with the YouTube channels that are starting Facebook causes, and all of those things that you hear in the happy, rosy discourse of, you know, digital kids, these are those kids. Now, they really are out there. The problem is that most kids are not those kids, right? So a lot of times when we have these debates, are is this technology good or bad, it's like, well, the pro people are looking at those kids, and then the people who are down on the technology are looking at the kids who aren't doing the amazing things. It's like what William Gibson famously said, the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. So it's just who you're looking at. You can't really say that the technology is the same for all kids. And so a big part of our research was just delivering this message that both of those realities are out there. You can't pretend that all kids experience the technology in the same way, even though we want to talk about them as a digital generation or kids these days as if they have the same experience. Their experiences are just as diverse as ours in terms of the priorities and interests that they're pursuing with technology. So one of the key distinctions that we'd put forward in our research was the distinction between friendship-driven and interest-driven learning and participation, where friendship-driven is really that baseline, that those social networks that reproduce the real-life networks, whether that's high school or college. Most of the activity is about popularity status, romantic negotiations, and it's happening on, you know, when we were doing our research, it was MySpace. Now it's Facebook and text messaging, but it's pretty just reproductive of what you see in cafeterias and locker rooms, pretty similar kind of status negotiations and displays. Now, what's different and what's really game-changing about the internet is the interest-driven learning and participation. And so this is the lives of the geeks, the dorks, the creative kids, the kids with interests that may not be, you know, very popular or hip within their local community. And these kids are going online to a different set of online environments to connect with other people who share those interests. And these online communities are often intergenerational in nature. It's not about popularity or looking good, but it's about knowledge and expertise and geeking out on areas of interest. And that is a fundamentally different dynamic than what you see in the friendship-driven networks and doesn't usually reproduce the same peer group you have in school, unless you happen to be a football player or a basketball player where you have an interest that's well represented and high status within your local community. So this distinction between friendship and interest-driven sites reproduces itself on different kinds of platforms as they evolve online. So when we were doing our research, the friendship-driven platform was MySpace, the interest-driven platform was LiveJournal. Today it's Facebook and Tumblr, probably, maybe Twitter. I mean, interest-driven platforms tend to be more varied. But these are sort of the resilient kinds of social divisions that govern teen social life. And as you think about technologies and platforms and genres for how to engage young people with new media, this is one of the most important fault lines to realize, because while intergenerational participation and learning-y stuff might be very welcome in the interest-driven world, it's actually pretty creepy for adults to be in the friendship-driven world in the same way. And so those kinds of distinctions become really important when you want to start crossing those boundaries between school and out of school. You know, the reality is that especially in high school now, college is different. The peer group that young people are thrown in with in a local institution aren't necessarily the best peers to further their creative and intellectual interests. And in fact, in too many peer groups of teens, it's profoundly uncool to care deeply about something, to be really into something. That's not really a high status play unless you're into something that has really high status in your peer group, which is probably a handful of interests between boys and girls that can really gain you status. Otherwise, you know, it really is about fashion, looking good, you know, things that are sort of the common currency of the realm. And so the online world suddenly opens up this opportunity for kids to experience peer cultures that are centered around their identities and interests and things they might want to get good at. So just to make it a little bit more concrete, I wanted to share an example of one young man who I interviewed as part of my case study of fans of Japanese animation. He was in finishing college when I interviewed him, and he had discovered web comics, I think, in his senior, in the summer before his senior year, and he he stayed at school, rural university, over the summer. All his friends were gone. He was bored. He was on the internet, and then he just fell in love with this genre and this community. He read everything he could. He checked out HTML for Dummies, did a bunch of online tutorials, and started creating web comics. Now, he said that he tried to change his major to get in alignment with his new interest in digital media and web development, but he couldn't find anything at school that really helped him out. But he found that it was really important that he had that time in his life to dedicate to learning. And he went and started developing his own site. And he step away from the mic. Started freelancing as a web developer. He started hosting web comics of other artists. He really found a community online that fueled his learning, his interest development. And he still hung out and partied with his friends in college, but none of them were interested in any of this. By the time I did a follow-up interview with him, he was actually making his living completely off being a web comics artist and selling merchandise and so on. So if you look at Dave's, how Dave's learning unfolded, I mean, he was unusual, right, in having a really passionate interest. I mean, not all kids have that, but that was his starting point. He fell in love with web comics. Now, the game changer as far as the internet was concerned was that he was able to not only find webcomics as a consumer, but he was able to connect with a community of producers who became his peer group, his source of feedback, learning, and expertise that really enabled him to become a successful artist, even though he had no courses in his school and he had no friends who shared this interest. So before the internet, you know, Dave never would have been able to develop this potential. And then finally, and what made Dave different from almost all of the other young people we talked to, was he was resourceful enough to then take what he was learning in the informal space, right, in the peer and interest space, and connect it back not only to his academic pursuits like technical skills and so on, but also to career opportunity. And it's very unusual, just to underscore, that young people are able to realize this full circle of what we're calling connected learning that really unites the interests, you know, with a supportive peer culture for the interests, and also the final most difficult piece is to tie that to opportunity. So we actually talked to a lot of kids who are geeking out on something on the internet, right? Most kids are into something, but that something is usually often kid world. It doesn't connect back to school. It doesn't connect back to career or civic pursuits. And so that's sort of the missing piece of the circle. That's really been our big challenge. The moral of the story is not that the internet creates kids like Dave, but the internet really won't unless we reach out from that bubble, the academic bubble, and actively try to recruit the interests and peer cultures of young people and connect it to the pathways to opportunity that are really represented by the institutions that we all come from, the adult world. And those kinds of connections aren't going to happen unless we're both creative, but also overcome this culture gap that really dictates the fact that, you know, social media or gaming or whatever is not really something that belongs within our walls. The reality is that young people need adult supports and guides, even though they love having their youth space. building those connections, if you can draw from where young people are and their interests are, they really, really do want and also need that to happen. The other issue, of course, is without that guidance, these same resources that become such an amazing tool and enabler for a young person like Dave can become a source of distraction, alienation from learning for kids if they don't see it connected to their future opportunity. You know, the reality, which, you know, is a lot in public perception about this new media, that it does detract from learning, you know, it does have a basis in reality because young people have choice and they have opportunity now. You know, sitting at the dinner table, they can text with your friends instead of talking with their parents. I mean, suddenly we have to be much more intentional about where we place our attention. We can't assume that within the walls of a room like this that, you know, you're not surfing the internet or texting your partner. I mean, there's no way that you can control attention in quite the same ways that you used to. And this represents a whole new host of challenges. And I think about it a bit like when our species suddenly encountered a world of calorie abundance instead of calorie scarcity, and all of our strategies for getting fats and sugars and proteins suddenly became incredibly maladaptive in an era of calorie abundance where we had to start making wise choices and we had to start limiting and thinking about boundaries. I think we're in the early years of really trying to figure out those approaches with our current media abundance. And it's not to say we want to go back to an era of scarcity. So that's the problem I have with just limit screen time kind of approaches. You have to develop the capacity to encounter that abundance and make wise choices. You know, your three-year-old is going to discover chocolate sometime. And so it's that developing the capacity to thrive in that environment. I mean, how many of us struggle with attention management every day? I'm sort of curious, how many of you have sort of deliberate strategies for managing social media and disrupted attention? Yeah, I mean, I think most of us, you know, we're in this fire hose situation, and we have to really think about the choices we make in ways that we didn't necessarily have to before. So that's why a lot of us who have been, you know, pretty much proponents of the potential of new media to make us smarter and more connected have increasingly been writing about, you know, the strategies and the kinds of dispositions we need to cultivate to thrive in the digital world. And we're realizing that it's not enough just to throw kids into the wilds of the internet and expect them to figure their, you know, their way home, so to speak, that really this is a new kind of educational agenda that's very different from pushing content and skills at kids, but it's really about developing preparation for future learning, for collaboration, for making wise choices. Howard Rheingold has talked about this in terms of different kinds of skills for thriving in the online world, like crap detection, attention management, and so on. You know, it's tough for kids these days because to get through the pathways that are still there in our traditional education institutions, they still have to do the content, they still have to do the skills, but they still have to do all this stuff too if they want to thrive in the world outside of the classroom. So I think we just should pause and recognize that our kids are, we're really asking a lot of them. You know, if content and skills, unless you know how to apply them and make them real world relevant in adaptive ways, it's not going to help them in their life outside of college. But to get through the gauntlet, they have to do so much more on the traditional achievement stuff as well. So, you know, the kids are living in a challenging time. And this is happening in the context, as I'm sure you're all aware, of rising inequity in educational attainment and economic equity in this country. Now, we all know that rates of college entrance and completion have been rising across the board, but when you really break it down based on income, the gap between rich and poor kids is growing. So this is what happens when suddenly people are handed more resources to do amazing things with their learning. The more privileged kids do a lot more with it. And so we're seeing this, you know, really sad and troubling gap. So the first two graphs are college completion and entrance. You know, everybody's doing better, but the rich kids are doing a lot better than the poor kids. Now, the thing that's most troubling to me is that third graph, which is actually out of school enrichment expenditures, where the gap has just risen so much more dramatically because this is discretionary income, whereas the richest quarter of families have tripled their expenditures on out-of-school enrichment from like $3,000 to almost $9,000, whereas, of course, for poor kids, this has been pretty much flatline. And so what wealthier families are realizing is that the learning that's going to help young people really thrive in the world outside of school requires this kind of investment, and that's the piece we're really trying to attack. Now, the question on the table for all of us is really whether the kinds of things we're involved in, whether it's open learning or in the classroom stuff, can really help in addressing not only helping our kids learn better, but helping all kids learn better. And I think, you know, clearly there's been sort of a sea change in the level of recognition that we've seen. OER has been around for a long time, but suddenly Khan and MOOCs have really changed the level of visibility. And it does seem like it's an period of tremendous opportunity. The challenge for me, though, is that what we know historically is that the build it and they will come kind of model of open network stuff tends to reinforce the privilege of the already advantaged. So that's what we saw on the graph before. That's why we see lower rates of diversity in high-tech careers. That's why we see the kinds of findings that we had in our digital use study, where the really digitally activated kids are doing amazingly well, and the not-so-activated kids are, who are alienated from school, use the technology as a way to disengage. This kind of finding is emerging repeatedly over research. So just putting content out there and saying, oh, anybody has access now, will just widen the equity gap, and that's troubling to me. So a few guiding principles that have come out of our connected learning work that we're trying to use as orienting marks for just policy and intervention design moving forward that I want to end with, and a few examples. First, leveraging local relationships. So again, if you're moving away from the build it and they will come to understanding that there needs to be supports and scaffolds, we know that geeks don't emerge fully formed from the internet. They become geeks through local peer cultures, LAN parties, hanging out in dorms. Girls learn about social media by looking at each other's Instagrams and Vines. It's within the warm body effect is incredibly important, especially for kids who don't already live in families and communities that immerse in high educational attainment and technology. So, the MacArthur Foundation and the Institute for Museum and Library Services have been partnering in building community-based learning labs in museums and libraries to, again, provide the social relational scaffolds for young people to discover and pursue digital interests. I love the example of Jaga Study, which is, a group in Bangalore that basically built this prefab school out of pallet beds, and they're guiding young people to software engineering programs using open MOOC content, but having local guides to really support their learning. Two, everyone can be a teacher. So this is the issue of capacity building in local communities, not just relying on the traditional experts. Now, I think it's a modern day miracle that you can wake up in the morning and ask the internet a question. I think Q&A forums are underappreciated in the educational technology world as really just an amazing learning and educational capacity building model. It's not just about geek content anymore, like Stack Exchange has all the English language geeks hanging out, answering questions. So this idea that everybody, what happens if you ask everybody to help guide learning? Peer-to-peer university is an example of, letting learners self-organize classes around open educational content. College courses like Phonar, run by Jonathan Wirth, at Coventry, he has an anchor, which is his real life course, but then he puts all the course materials online, invites everybody on the internet to participate in Flickr and Instagram, wherever they are, aggregates it, and then everybody else starts helping and commenting and teaching everybody else. A similar DS106, a digital storytelling class run by Jim Groom, he's run it for a couple years, similar to the Phonar model, you know, anchor in a university course, but invites the internet to participate. And then this fall he said, well, what if I just don't teach and I just let the internet do it? So Headless DS106 launched this fall. We'll see how that goes. Three, meet learners where they are. And again, this is just the interest-driven principle, especially for kids who aren't already educationally elite kids. Find them in their interests if you possibly can. We do work with like StarCraft commentators who have a lot of cachet in kids' peer cultures. I love Harry Potter Alliance, which mobilizes fans of Harry Potter for social good. All interests are online now. We're doing a case study of fiber arts, Ravelry.com, great learning community. I'll just plug my local institution just once, which is the Walking Dead MOOC, which, you know, again, a great example of meeting young people where they are in their interests. Just, you know, openness to that possibility. And then finally, the issue of recognition, credentialing, assessment. How can you recognize learning in the wild that's happening in all these informal kinds of settings? It's not about an assessment-driven regime, but getting much more granular about skills, experiences, and the fact that they might be acquiring those skills and experiences in settings that are outside formal instruction. On the high-tech fields, this is really already advanced pretty far. So a site like TopCoder has really granular kinds of metrics for the kinds of achievements that designers and coders demonstrate through meeting the challenges that are sponsored on the site. You know, LinkedIn is starting to have skills and expertise. So this is happening. This train is on its track. It would be really great to figure out proactive forms of connectivity with higher ed. And then we've been partnering with the Mozilla Foundation, developing an open badging infrastructure, which is really to say that everybody should be able to do this, you know, any program, any institution, and make the learning much more visible and under learner control. So again, just to close, you know, these are these strategies of leveraging local communities, the capacity of peer-to-peer teaching and learning, meeting young people where they are, alternative credentialing system. These are all examples of how we're trying to build the connective tissue between these spheres of learning that are often disconnected in young people's lives. And these connections aren't just connections for connection's sake, but really addressing that fundamental question of equity that I think should drive so much of our thinking. Rather than complaining about, you know, whether this technology is good or bad, I think the question is really to say, how can we make it better, and how can we make it better in ways that are really helping all young people? So I invite you to join a growing community that we're trying to mobilize around these ideas of connected learning, which is really a cross-sector, intergenerational kind of approach, including educators, researchers, policymakers, administrators, technology, designers, youth, and parents, trying to work out and share solutions under this rubric. So I think, do we have time for a few questions before we break to the hallway? Oh, and I have some pamphlets, I think, near the entrance if anybody wants physical materials.
Thanks very much for your presentation. What do you see, as far as you've been studying this for a while now with MySpace and then the Facebook and the areas you mentioned, what kind of disruptive change and what is already disruptive by definition do you see in the next few years? Do you see anything that's going to really surprise us yet again?
Well, I think once smartphones become a for everybody kind of thing, that's going to be a big disruptor. So I think we're right at the beginning of that tipping point, but that kind of ubiquitous access, we're really already seeing pretty interesting new genres of mobile communication through, even the relatively privileged kind of kids who are using smartphones now. But I think that's completely unpredictable, and the potential to have those technologies more integrated into practices and the environment and so on is still, I think we're in really early days on that.
Hi, Mimi.
Hi.
I wanted to know, I work at Sonoma State, and we credential student teachers, and as part of a CSU system, we're the largest credentialer in the nation. And I know you mentioned credentialing, but I'm not sure you were talking about teacher prep, but that is a huge gateway into teaching within California. And I wanted to know what would be the advice you could give me to give to me so I could go back to my community and say, here's where I think we need to go in this changing landscape, because our struggle is always, do we teach the way that we're currently teaching, or do we try to teach to future schools and what future schooling and learning might look like? And so I want to know what advice, if that was a coherent question, you give me to take back to my colleagues in teacher prep?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I guess I might throw it back to you or other folks who have more expertise in this area, is whether there are efforts to do sort of more granular kinds of credentialing. And I mean, because that's really what badging means. It's to make it more granular so that you don't just have that one credential or diploma or so on, but that you can start decomposing skills and also allow for more constant updating and lifelong learning that happens even after the formal program. So I think that any experimentation on that end would be really, really interesting on the teacher training and prep side. I guess it's not prep anymore, it's training.
Hi, I teach online. I teach history class online. And I try to do sort of what you're talking about here, create an engaging class where I want the students learning from each other. But I found that, I don't know exactly the reason, but some students really don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's either it's different from the other online classes they have, so they have maybe an expectation that it's just going to be sort of a self-guided learning, or they just don't like the group work. So I'm wondering, if students live in a social online world outside of class, why are they maybe hesitant to capture that and do that in an academic environment?
Yeah, no, I think it's really, really challenging because, we have these existing genres and expectations for what the formal education system, we've pounded it into our kids that, that system is about, it's not about engagement, it's not about social, it's about meeting expectations and all those things that they've learned in their 12 years of schooling. And then suddenly you say, oh, well, this is about sharing and it's about, engagement and choice. It's not easy, I think, to negotiate that culture shift immediately. And so, like the experiments like Phonar and so on, they benefit from the fact that a lot of the people, there's a self-selection going on, right? So when you throw it open, you get people who are photography geeks and are really into it, and they've selected into these activities, which are different from the students you'll have locally who are still fitting this genre of, they're trying to get through their program and so on. And so I do think that we're kind of in this pain point of a, transition and translation zone. I think that's precisely one of the challenges of the connected learning model, is trying to figure out, well, what are the triggers that get kids to pop into, to see it as their fun social? I mean, not in the way. So I think there's two bad ways to do it that I've seen happen. They're hard to avoid, but, one is, when I was advocating for faculty to use social media, way back when blogs were just starting up, and the kids were like, why would I want to blog in school? That's like blogging with your mom. So, like, getting the genres right and mixing the friendship versus interest becomes really difficult and problematic. So, it really has to be an interest-driven activity for it to work for young people on the engagement side. And then the other is what Jim G calls the chocolate-covered broccoli problem. So, it's putting like a veneer of pop culture on something otherwise unpleasant, right? That's also something that happens a lot in, the space where we're working in and out of school. And I think it's like really important that the broccoli actually tastes good, that it's not just about the chocolate, but it is hard. Like, even if you look at something like the Walking Dead MOOC, like, what is that, a chocolate-covered broccoli, or is that authentically, they would really get into the disease and, the scientific and social issues without the Walking Dead thing. I mean, it's good to experiment with those spaces, but I think there's definitely these pitfalls to watch out for.
Got time for one more question?
Okay. My question is about the role of faculty. And as you were talking, I work in a teaching and learning center, And one of the challenges, as many other centers face, is involving teachers. So I think the question about having students sort of get on board with connected learning is easy, but I think how do you get faculty to get on board with connected teaching, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, no, that I think that's a really good question. And, you know, my colleagues who work more with educators, they really stress the fact that the teachers having that same experience of connected learning themselves, like they can't really do it for their students without themselves being connected and social learners themselves. So I think what you're pointing to is really the critical importance of us spending attention on that side of the equation as much as, you know, you just can't say, I mean, there are a bunch of faculty who are already culturally on board with, you know, social stuff, but a lot aren't. And, you know, providing those experiences, I mean, it has to be experiential. You can explain it till you're blue in the face, but unless you get that, you know, like on your online video and feel really good about it, you're not really going to get why that's such a strong motivator for participation. So I think you're raising a really important point. Well, thank you, everybody. I think we do have the opportunity, if anyone wants to continue the conversation, to meet outside in the hallway.